Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello and welcome to The Parenthood. From the moment sleep-deprived parents moan about the toddler years, we're prepared for the awfulness of the teenage years. We're told that teenagers no longer need their parents, and it's reassuring to think that in a bid to make that separation of parent and child easier, our teenagers turn into mean, selfish people in their bid for independence. That their difficult natures and moodiness make it easier for us, their doting parents, to let go. They're essentially being cruel to be kind. My guest today disputes this idea, insisting that if we are adept enough at understanding our teens, these challenges can bring great joy. Dr. Terry Apter is a psychologist and author whose 10 books have explored relationships within the family dynamic. She says it was a conversation with her daughter who inspired her to challenge this theory. She says, "We were on the train from Cambridge to London. She must have been about six. She remarked that when she was older, she'd be able to come to London with me more often. I responded that when she was a teenager, she wouldn't want me with her. She looked shocked and sorrowful. A thought that was painful for me was also painful to her. I came to wonder whether current theories about adolescence were correct." Terry, thank you so much for joining me today. I'd love to start with exploring this myth that teenagers are a nightmare and that essentially they are divorcing their parents.
Yes, that's exactly the term that Anna Freud used when she was describing adolescence. And she was at the forefront of talking about adolescence as a psychiatrist, psychoanalyst, because the whole notion of adolescence came very late to psychological theory. So it wasn't until, the 30s, 1930s, 1940s, that people even began to speak about adolescence from a psychological point of view. And Anna Freud said that it was a teen-parent version of psychological divorce, that the teen was divorcing the parent, separating from the parent. And this was a way to understand the teen's behavior, that the teen was rude, rebellious, irritable, that all of these upheavals are part of the rupture that one thinks of as divorcing someone who has been very close to you. Now, this model, I think, is linked to another myth, and it's linked to the myth that in order to be a proper human adult, you have to be independent, you have to be separate, you have to stand on your own two feet, not be too influenced or too dependent on people close to you. It's really what I think of as the Marlborough man myth, the idea that glory, value is in, being alone, being your own guy, really. And the idea that to have your identity formed, you have to be separate from other people. So in psychology, the notion of individuation, being your own self, having your own identity, was always paired with separation. You become an individual, your own person, by separating from, you know, the parents who have guided you. And that was how adolescence was seen. And again, based on the myth that that's what a good grown-up person is, someone who's really separated from other people.
And so talk me through why we think that that is not the case. Because, I mean, I look at my life now, I'm married, and actually I really rely on the support of my husband, but also my sisters, my parents, and my friends. It's, you know, without them, I would be far less strong and far less able to navigate life.
Well, indeed, it's really very difficult to understand. Once you see a problem with a theory, it's very difficult to understand why it was accepted for so long. But I think it was as a stereotype. And one enabling aspect of the stereotype was that, you know, until the end of the 1980s, until the 1990s, psychologists were not looking at female adolescents. They were only looking at boy teens. And when you look at boy teens, it's a little bit more plausible because they do like personal boundaries. They aren't so upfront about their connections. When I started looking at girl teens in the 1990s, I saw something so different, that they were still very attached to their parents, still working very hard at this relationship. Wasn't always going well. They weren't always, you know, working at it efficiently, but clearly it was something that mattered to them. And I thought at the time that that was something that was true of girl teens and not of boy teens. So more recently, I, as well as other people, have been taking a new look at boy teens as well. And you see that what you learn about girl teens applies to boy teens as well. We really got it wrong about what adolescence was all about. And if you looked at what was happening in the here and now, you know, looking at the conversations, looking at the arguments, hearing what parents said about teens, what teens said about parents, you could see that something else was going on. And this was much better than stepping back and saying, you know, according to some theory, what's going on. Another thing that really changed the way we think about adolescence was derived from the new brain imaging techniques that started being in play in the late 1990s and very much into today. So we have magnetic resonance imaging and functional magnetic resonance imaging that allows us to see activity in the brain, how it's working, and also its structure. You couldn't do that on living brains before this. And so now what you have is a better image of how the brain is developing structurally during adolescence, how it's very different from a child's brain or a grown-up's brain. That there's a big mass of gray matter, and that mass is gradually being pruned so that the brain works much more efficiently. And at the same time, the connections are growing and becoming more robust. And so different parts of the brain are communicating better with one another. In particular, that prefrontal executive lobe of the brain in adolescence is communicating very inefficiently with the more emotional limbic part of the brain, but that improves at the end of adolescence. And teens are processing their social world in a very different way from either children or grown-ups. And so understanding that adolescence is a key phase of development, and that the task is far more complicated than the developmental task that was previously seen, that of separating from the parents. You know, it's much more nuanced, much more creative. So that was, again, a reminder that you really have to take a new look at adolescence.
I mean, the key of the kind of crux of this is that, you know, for decades we've misunderstood our teens.
Yes.
They're sort of almost crying out for help, going, no, I do need your support.
Yes.
We've been interpreting as it as, well, you don't need me anymore, so
yes.
Fine.
Yes.
How does this happen in real life? What is typical behaviour? How did we potentially previously interpret it? And what are they actually trying to say to us?
Well, one of the things that you hear parents say regularly is, I can never say the right thing, or my teen always criticizes me. You know, I can never do anything right. And, you know, I might as well not say anything. They don't want to hear me talk. And that is wrong. They do want to hear you. Let's start with that. I always say the wrong thing, and, you know, they don't want to hear me talk. They actually do want to hear you talk, but they're a hypercritical of it because they want you to get it right. I mean, teens have high expectations of their parents. They've learned in childhood to have high expectations of a parent's response. You know, think about a parent with an infant, that close, curious, loving focus on what the infant is feeling, what that gesture means, what the facial expression means, what this movement means. I want to understand who my child is, and I want to respond accordingly. And this continues in many respects throughout childhood. Not getting it right all the time, absolutely, but nonetheless, that engaged, curious, loving focus. And so they have, most teens come into adolescence having high expectations of their parents. So when a parent says something that suggests they're out of date, they're not keeping up to date with who the teen is, or they haven't got what the teen wants to be or who the teen hopes they might be, then, you know, they'll criticize it, that, you know, you don't get it, you don't understand it. And it can be something very simple, like, we're going to visit your cousin, I know you like seeing him. I don't like seeing him. Why do you think I used to, but I don't. You know, you look lovely. That isn't what I'm aiming for. I don't want to look lovely. I want to look, you know, smart or distinctive, unique. You know, you've got the word wrong, and I need you to get it right. I want to sort of shake you into a new awareness of who I am and who I'm becoming. So, you know, that's they're critical in order to correct and update that very important resonance, because they want that, you know, that sort of click, that satisfying click that someone understands me, someone really important to me understands me, and the parent is really important to them.
So what should our response be in that kind of situation? Because part of me sort of feels like, okay, well, I'll give up then. Fine.
That's really interesting, because what I've noticed is that when parents interpret that, you know, you don't get it, you don't understand, as, oh, okay, you want me to step back. I understand you want to separate. I understand you're being difficult. I understand that there's no business talking, you know, you can't get it right with the teens, so I'll give up. When they have that mindset, then quarrels are more common and more likely to escalate. But when they see this as, my teen is trying to get me to take another look more closely, this is an identity reminder, and I have to sort of regauge my attention and see what it is my teen is trying to say, then those little barks, those little, you know, the little glitches, actually become opportunities to get together again and to revitalize the relationship. So it isn't easy because, you know, parents have their pride and they also have their own concerns. You know, they'll sometimes be stressed. And so, you know, the immediate sense of criticism, you're not saying the right thing. You know, you bark back. But with the overarching mindset of my teen is, you know, trying to update me, trying to communicate with me and wants me alongside, that goes a long way to breaking down the anxiety and the insult that parents often feel that makes the relationship much more tense and more volatile.
And often in that situation, it's quite difficult to have a conversation to say, rather than say, to say, God, you're just a difficult teenager, to say, oh, I hadn't realised that.
Yeah,
is it better to have that conversation then and there, or leave it a bit and then revisit it so that you're signalling to them, I hear you, I heard you, and actually I do want to find out more about you?
Well, you know, it isn't easy. It isn't easy getting to know a teen. And so some teens will, you know, they're already, you know, in a state of high negative arousal. I'm cross with my mom, say. And so you can cut that. So they may not be willing to follow up the conversation then. They may, you know, need a little time to calm down. Sometimes they may be willing to talk right then and there, but a lot of dealing with a teen is looking out for those windows of opportunity to talk and, you know, showing that you're willing and that you're not rejecting the teen because, you know, you yourself are not closed to conversation. And sometimes it does take a while, especially if it's a very heated issue about, you know, strong emotions. So another aspect of teens is that their emotions do tend to be very strong, you know, what's called reactive, you know, high arousal, a lot of tension. They're working very hard to understand their own emotions, and they use a much more, or are developing a much more nuanced language about emotions. So sometimes a parent will say, well, you know, I can see you're really angry. And a teen will say, well, no, that's not it. I'm frustrated, or I'm not angry, I'm enraged, something like that. And so they are working to develop a much more subtle and, you know, language for emotions, complex language of emotions, but they're not yet able to manage these. And that accounts for a lot of the high, you know, it's not hormones, it's dealing with understanding how complex emotions are, being very interested in their own emotions, and yet being unable brain-wise to manage them. So sometimes they need just time to settle down before they can talk about something. But good advice, I think, to a parent is when a teen says, I don't want to talk and, you know, leave me alone, it's not a question of, not a matter of not asking more questions or learning not to talk about it, but learning to ask better questions and waiting for the opportunity where your teen does seem about ready to say something to you or will listen to something you say, and asking calmly, you know, specific questions, indicating you want to be led by the teen. You want information. You don't know. You're not going to tell the teen what they think. You really want to know what it is they think. And of course, this can be very difficult for parents, especially when those emotions are negative. You know, you don't want to hear your teen say, you know, my life is awful and no one likes me and I feel hopeless and I don't like myself. And sometimes parents need to listen to that. And talking about that, can one help the teen define the emotion more clearly? And defining, you know, naming to tame, that really works with emotions. And also reminding the teen that that isn't all they feel. So, you know, no one likes me. You know, are you sure? What about your sister? What about your dog? What about me? What about another friend? Just reminding them that that negative emotion, which seems like the whole world in that moment, isn't necessarily the whole world.
And is it quite normal for teens to have this sort of catastrophic idea of their lives? Because I think possibly one of the reasons parents find it really difficult to address that is that it's terrifying. You know, the idea that our teens are desperately unhappy, that potentially have catastrophic mental health problems, it's a very, very scary thing for us to address. Yes. And I suppose if we have the knowledge that these emotions and feelings are pretty standard for teens, and it doesn't necessarily mean that we're going to have a sort of big psychological breakdown on our hands.
Yes. Well, so I think accepting that negative emotions are necessary, we have to learn how to deal with them. Some parents and some teens themselves and some teachers believe that teens should be protected from difficult emotions. I mean, that's one of the theories behind the widely used practice of trigger warnings. You know, let me warn you that something unpleasant is coming up and I want to protect you from it. We can't, parents co-regulate their children and their teens. You know, they help calm a child down. With a teenager, you have to find new ways. You used to be able to hug a child. You can't always hug a teen in the same way, but sometimes you can just sit with a teen. So you can help the teen regulate, manage that panic, that sense of catastrophe. But they have to learn what it's like to weather these difficult emotions, to sit back, let it ride through them, you know, with breathing, and then just let it, experiencing also that it ebbs, you know, that it overwhelms them, but then it can go. And that kind of experience will give them much more strength in, you know, handling the next big downtime. But when you say our teens, you know, this catastrophizing is this typical of teens, yes, it is. But the other point is their elation when something goes well, and, you know, their excitement. And sometimes that excitement is wonderful, and sometimes it's very dangerous because, you know, think of the excitement for adventure they have, particularly when they're with their friends, and that can lead to them taking, you know, risks that, you know, you say, my teen did this, my teen is smart. That's
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Thing only a stupid person would do, but it, you know, smart teens can become stupid in the moment. It's you know, looking at the whole world through the mood of the moment that is very typically teen. And sometimes that's wonderful and sometimes it's awful. But getting back to what you said about concern about mental health, you know, sometimes it does lead to a breakdown. And what I always want to say to parents is, you know, this doesn't mean that your teen is broken. This doesn't mean your teen can't be mended. It's very difficult, and there are certain cases where, you know, professional help really needs to step in. But, you know, they can mend. They will probably mend. The odds are in their favor. And it's not, you know, it's not something that's broken inside them. It's, you know, a problem that they're in some way working on, and they can be helped to work on it more efficiently.
Yeah, I like this idea that it's sort of part of, you know, education, as it were. They're yes. teaching them how to deal with difficult emotions yes. that often will be more challenging as they, you know, get into adult life. I mean, it seems to me that the heart of this is that communication, you know, maintaining that conversation, maintaining that kind of open door. But teens are typically very uncommunicative. Yes. How do you communicate with a teen that really doesn't seem to want to communicate with you?
Well, most teens do ultimately want to communicate with their parents. I mean, you know, there are teens who have had a really difficult childhood where they have learned that being close to someone, you know, in their experience, being close to someone is extremely painful and they want to avoid it. But, you know, most of your listeners will be parents who, you know, are positively engaged. And so it's learning anew the signals that you spent so much time watching out for in infancy. You know, this is when my teen is willing to talk. This is when I have to leave my teen alone. This is when touching my teen will have a positive response. This is when my teen really can't tolerate being touched, needs to be left alone. You know, showing the openness and the curiosity. I really want to know about you. You know, I'm not it. So I think, you know, parents have to balance, make sure that their conversations with the teen are not always about the parent's agenda. You know, good morning, this is what I think you should do, and this is what we're doing today, and no argument about that. I mean, sometimes you need conversations like that, but you want to balance them with something that's much more open. And it can start with little things. You know, what did you think about that you were watching, that we were watching together? What do you think about this? Would you like this? Do you still like this? Is this helpful to you? And just, you know, again, saying, I've got, this person is now changing rapidly and doesn't quite know what they're changing into, may have some sense of who they hope they're changing into, but they want a parent's, you know, mirroring to help them define themselves, just as they did in infancy and childhood. So, you know, it's learning that it's learning the ropes again. And I'm not saying it's easy, and I'm not saying you're going to get it right every time, but you don't have to. I mean, you know, people talk about being how important it is to be responsive to a child, and parents worry, oh, I missed this and I messed up and, you know, I've ruined the relationship, or I've damaged my child. Well, in fact, it's been found that as long as a parent is in sync, responsively in sync, about 30% of the time, of their interactions, then that's sufficient to do a very good job. You don't need to do it all the time, but to give a model of what getting it right looks like is enough.
That is so reassuring to hear. 30%, that's fantastic, because you definitely get that idea that good enough is sort of 80% of the time. But actually, I feel that I get it wrong way more than 20% of the time. So hearing that, as long as they have an idea of what, you know, good enough looks like, that I'm not damaging my children psychologically.
Well, indeed. And, you know, the concept of good enough doesn't only mean that it's important, you know, that you don't have to be perfect. It also means that being perfect is not great for your child, that it models an unrealistic and uncomfortable sense of what a relationship is. So it's very good for us all to experience a relationship that can break apart or seem to rupture at one point, but then mends again. So rupture and repair, you learn that you learn the resiliency of relationships, that they can take a bash here and there, that they won't be working well-oiled all the time, but it will return to something that's very comfortable. So that's another very important lesson that they learn from, you know, this conflict with their parents.
And it makes sense. You know, the closest friends I have are the ones that I've fallen out with. In fact, the closest relationships I have are with my sisters. And that's probably because as children, no holds were barred. We beat each other up. We said the meanest things to each other. And we're so, so, so close nowadays, probably because of that, because we had so much rupture in our relationship. We managed to repair it.
Yes. And you're no longer afraid of conflict. It's not something that you have to step back from. And stepping back from that kind of conflict can make the relationship a bit brittle, because, you know, you feel it's fragile and it isn't. Yeah.
And I suppose it's really important for our children to know that as well. That, you know, just because there has been rupture with the parents, that doesn't mean that's the end of the world. But also for their relationship with their peers and potentially romantic relationships going forward.
Absolutely. Yes, it's a good life lesson.
I'm thinking about, you know, some teenage behavior is often very antisocial and wrong. And, you know, there are definitely times with my children, and my parents, I'm sure, had it with me, saying, no, this is not okay. At what point do you stop being the understanding parent who says, okay, fine, you know, it's the hormones, it's the adolescence, I'm going to try and understand it, to say, I have had enough of this, you're grounded, or you're whatever it is, you're punishing them, essentially. Is that ever okay?
Oh, of course.
And does it ever work? Yes.
Well, first of all, punishing teens is often necessary. Teens tend to be more receptive to carrots than to sticks, you know, so sometimes it's better to say, if you in the future show me you are not this irresponsible, you are not this reckless, you're not this inconsiderate, then we can think about something that you like, and that will have a positive effect, you know. But teens do need to learn that their actions have consequences, and that that consequence may be a problem for them, which they have to learn to solve. So that's one thing. That's the sort of wise way of approaching discipline. But there will also be, because parents are human, there will also be the impulsive way of punishing your kid by shouting at them and showing your great displeasure and disappointment, because that's what you feel. And you can do that. It's a good step then to say, well, this is an opportunity for me to say, I was so disappointed because I thought you were responsible and you've done this and I don't understand it. And can you see what you've done? And can you see why you did it? In many cases, it doesn't really help to say, what were you thinking of? Why did you do it? Even though that's the question you want to ask, because, you know, the teen will be thinking, well, it was fun at the moment. You know, I'm looking at the whole world through the moment, and it seemed like a good idea at the moment. So, you know, it's not going to be a simple conversation to have where the parent's wisdom is going to lead to enlightenment on the part of the teen. But you have to go through this. So, you know, I'm not against punishment, and I don't think that understanding means that you're not going to lose your temper yourself, that you have to put up and accept bad behavior. You know, you can say, this is very hurtful to me. I'm really upset to hear you say this. I thought it was rude. And that tends to be better than saying, what a horrible person you are. what awful person have I raised? Things like that.
I like that, you know, the idea that instead of saying, right, you're grounded, that you sort of repackage it into, until you show me that you're responsible enough to, you know, be given the agency to go out.
Yes.
Because then you're essentially saying to them, I believe you have it in you. You're not a totally bad
person.
Yes,
that's right.
You're looking to show me where that responsibility is there.
Absolutely. Yeah, so you're looking ahead to a more positive future as opposed to, you know, dwelling on the awful thing that's in the past. Yeah.
And how important is it for parents to show their sort of extreme emotions? I mean, I'm just thinking back to this morning when my children were just being really testing and I dropped them off and I cried because I felt I was such a bad mother because they pushed all my buttons.
Yeah.
And yet we're brought up to sort of think, you know, we mustn't kind of cry out of frustration in front of our children. But could that potentially be beneficial? How important is it for us to sort of show our frustration and show our children that we too find it hard? Or is it better to sort of, you know, just take a deep breath, try and present a stronger kind of view as possible? What's the best there?
Well, you know, think back to the 30% rule and the rupture and repair. So, I mean, parents are going to lose it. And I think it would be pretty annoying to have a parent who never did. You know, you would feel you were never able to get in there and press those buttons. You know, younger kids in particular want to know that they can rile their parents, that, you know, the parent who is so powerful, they have some power over them. So it's not something I would recommend as a model, but it's inevitable that it happens. And I don't think that it's helpful to deny that it happens, or certainly there's no evidence that, you know, losing your temper sometimes psychologically damages children. It's another way of learning that, you know, people can be overwhelmed, but then they can step out of that, they can regain composure, they can maintain self-respect and authority, even though they've lost it. So, you know, it's a life lesson. It's not one that you want to teach deliberately, but, you know, it will happen, and they can learn from it.
Well, exactly. And actually that modeling of almost apologizing and saying, I wasn't proud of the way I behaved.
Yeah.
You as a parent, and I suppose as a parent, you are the most important person in their life, especially as they're transitioning into those teenage years. To hear someone say, I'm sorry, and I'm not proud of that behavior, you're giving them the permission to do it. And actually,
Maybe also explain why. You know, I was disappointed that you were so unresponsive. You know, I needed you to get ready. It was important, and you were really messing me about. You know, depending on the child's age, they can understand that. A teen would understand that. Might not mind, but would understand it.
And in terms of how, you know, when you refer to teens, it's sort of broad, and we know that children mature at slightly different rates.
Yeah.
I mean, presumably, when would you say this is all starting, this kind of disruption in their brain, and is it at 13 or is it sometimes a little bit before that?
Oh, it's sometimes a little bit before, and so it's at about 10 or 11 that you get that mass of gray matter, which offers opportunity for brain development, but also leads for a period to a lot of inefficient messaging between the different parts of the brain. What's also unexpected is how long adolescence lasts, because, you know, we think that 18, 19, 20, you should be all grown up. Well, if you look at brain development, it's really not until the age of 24 that you have a nice streamlined brain with not too much gray matter, you know, not this dense thicket that confuses things, and also very strong connections to the good bits, the good kind of connections, the coordination and integration. You don't get that until about the age of 24. And this should be really part of our justice system, because a lot of 14, 15, 16-year-olds who do awful things, you know, you spoke about antisocial things. This is not only in the home, but outside the home, getting them caught into the judicial system. You know, by the age of 24, they'll be perfectly fine citizens. And, you know, a lot of people have been working very hard to get that in more deeply into the system of our structures of our society. But we're not quite there yet.
That makes sense, although it's definitely a little bit scary, the idea that the teenage years last a lot longer. And the other thing is that when I think back to my teenage years, I don't remember any of this. I mean, I kind of think my parents had a really easy ride, but I'm sure it's more that my brain has literally let go of those more challenging moments. Is that the case, that we typically don't remember the...
Yeah, that's a really interesting question, because in some ways you remember more about teen experiences. So for the rest of your life, the music that you came to love as a teen will resonate with you in a certain way, because that's when, you know, your brain was being formed in certain ways, and it, you know, it influenced it. And so it sort of fits in to who you are, and it has a special meaning to you. On the other hand, it's sometimes difficult. You know, just as it's difficult to remember our very early years because our brain was structured in a very different way, or lacked structure at that time about timing, things like that. So it's difficult to construct memories from our very, very early years. It can sometimes be difficult to remember the context of teen emotions. So you might remember that you felt a great deal of irritability with your, you know, you were really irritated with your parents, but you don't quite remember why. Or you remember, you know, an overwhelming love or crush you had, but you can't quite remember what it was that seemed so wonderful. So, you know, your brain's really taking you to a different place, and it may be difficult then to construct the emotions of that almost different mentality.
Well, I suppose it's probably not a bad exercise to have a chat with our parents and go, what was I like as a teenager, and see how your memories differ.
Indeed, yes, yes. But, you know, some parents do have an easy ride, partly because their expectations are so, you know, are so awful. And so if they don't have that, they may, the continuing relationship may be more salient, will be more salient in some, you know, parent-teen pairs than in others. And for that, the parents will have a much rosier sense of how it was in the teen years.
I've often thought, you know, I think a lot about kind of parenting, doing this podcast and teaching the antenatal classes that I do. And I think often at the kind of heart of parental love is that unconditional love. And you obviously want your child to know that you will love them whatever they do. I think sometimes considering that teenagers have then suddenly a bit more power, it is still important for them to understand that you will love them whatever. But do you tell them that explicitly? Do you make absolutely sure that whatever they do, you will love them? Or is it better not to be so sort of upfront about that and manifest that feeling in your actions and your listening, as you know?
Well, I think that teens are more interested in a parent recognizing them, understanding them, seeing who they are or who they are becoming, than they are in love. And sometimes teens say to me, oh, well, yes, she loves me, but that's because I'm her daughter, she's my mother, she doesn't really know who I am. And it's that they're concentrating on. So if a parent says, I love you unconditionally, you know, they know that, they've got that message, and they're not interested in hearing it again. What they're interested in is, do you have the parental energy to get to know who I am and understand my signals and stop misinterpreting me and, you know, telling me I'm rude when what I want is to have a better conversation. So it's a different balance.
And that's where the joy comes in, because obviously
The joy comes in. Yes, yes. Learning what an exciting person your child is becoming. Yeah.
Well, Terry, it's been so lovely to chat to you. You fill me with lots of hope, and it's certainly a really refreshing way to sort of look at the teenage years, which certainly for me are approaching fast.
Yes.
Terry is the author of 10 books exploring familial relationships. Her latest, The Teen Interpreter, A Guide to the Challenges and Joys of Raising Adolescents, is available now. Terry, thank you for your time today. And for all of those of you listening, thank you for listening to this episode of The Parenthood. You can subscribe, rate and review wherever you found this podcast. You can also follow me on Instagram. I'm at marina.fogel. But in the meantime, from Terry and me, thanks for listening.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.